Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, could Valley residents someday get around in air taxis?
And do you know Arizona's state mammal? Well, they've been finding themselves in some tough situations during the summer's heat wave.
But first, it is finally here. It is Election Day, and Arizona's 11 crucial electoral votes will be decided for either Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump.
Farther down the ballot, we'll find out the winners in races for U.S. Senate, the House of Representatives, countywide races, and local politicos are watching to see if Democrats can flip control of either chamber of the state legislature.
That's not to mention the long list of propositions on this year's ballot. Voters are weighing in now on everything from abortion rights to how our elections run to immigration enforcement.
But don't expect results all that soon. Election officials in Maricopa County have warned voters not to expect results for days, and they say they don't expect to count every vote for 10 to 13 days.
More than 2 million Arizonans have already voted, but Maricopa County election officials are warning voters to expect lines at the polls today. Here is Assistant County Manager Zach Shira.
But as Americans, we're used to waiting in line. We wait in line for coffee. We wait in line for our groceries. Sometimes we wait in line for new sneakers or video games, if that's your thing. We can wait in line to exercise our right to vote.
This election has already been rife with concerns about security, from the safety of voters and poll workers to ensuring all votes are counted. Election officials here say they're prepared. Here's Shira again.
We will not be playing whack-a-mole, but what we will be taking very seriously is any misinformation that impacts a voter's ability to vote a ballot. That misinformation we will be very aggressive in reporting.
Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richards said yesterday that more than 1 million early ballots have been processed to be included in the county's first batch of results. That'll be posted around 8 o'clock tonight, with another 425 to 475,000 early ballots ready to be processed for tomorrow's results.
Let's turn now to a check-in at the polls with the show's Sam Dingman, who's been out in the field this morning talking to voters who are voting. Good morning there, Sam. Sam, do we have you on the line? Looks like we have lost our connection with the show's Sam Dingman. We will return to that check-in after this.
A coalition of groups last week hosted the first ever Arizona Advanced Air Mobility Summit in Scottsdale. Advanced air mobility refers to drones, but also a new kind of air transportation that uses electric or hybrid electric aircraft that operate kind of like helicopters. They're called eVTOLs, which stands for Electric Vertical Takeoff and Landing. That means they don't need runways. And my next guest believes they're well-suited to operate inside and within cities to move both people and cargo, like an air taxi. Michelle Olson is Chief Client Officer and Head of the Aerospace and Defense and Advanced Air Mobility Practice for the PR firm Lambert. She joins me to talk more about this emerging industry. And Michelle, what is the status of eVTOLs in Arizona, especially because the state has in the recent past been pretty receptive to this kind of new transportation technology?
You know, Arizona is really advanced in a lot of ways, technologically advanced. So with our autonomous vehicles, they're everywhere now here in the Phoenix metropolitan area. And with our chip manufacturing and battery production, hydrogen power production, there are manufacturers here of semi-trucks that are hydrogen powered. And we've got, I think, some presence of every electric vehicle that's being manufactured or batteries that are being manufactured here. So we're very far advanced in that regard. We're also far advanced in having aerospace companies and contractors that are here in Arizona. What we're not advanced in are these particular aircraft. And so I think Arizona is very well poised to attract the production of some of these aircraft, and more importantly, to attract the operations where we get the aircraft here and we can start utilizing them to hop between cities in a quicker, more sustainable way than sitting on a freeway.
Well, that's the part that I'm particularly interested in terms of how these might be used here, because, you know, we hear all the time what good flying conditions the Phoenix area typically has. I'm wondering, like, in your perfect world, what would it look like to have these sort of air taxis, you know, operating along with all the other types of, you know, ground taxis and rideshare and autonomous vehicles and, you know, all the other ways that people can get around if they're not driving their own car?
I think in my perfect world, it would take kind of our more farther out cities and connect them more readily to downtown Phoenix and also to each other. So imagine you have business in Buckeye and then you have business in the afternoon in Chandler, and you want to get between those two cities without sitting on I-10 for an hour, which is typically what it might take without rush hour. So in 15 minutes between Buckeye and Chandler, you could fly and get to your next appointment much quicker. Or if you are, say there's an accident on I-10 and all avenues to get public safety there are closed, it's really easy to get an eVTOL into the scene of an accident and drop a doctor off, or inevitably remove a patient without disrupting the process of cleaning up that accident and relieving congestion around it sooner.
What kinds of regulations need to be in place before these can really, pardon the pun, take off? I mean, we've seen, for example, policymakers kind of struggle at times with how to regulate drones, for example, you know, something else that flies in the air. What kinds of regulations, what kind of rules do you think need to be in place before these can really become something that are ubiquitous?
I think outside of the aircraft being certified so that they're safe and reliable and all of that, and the industry really focuses on safety first. So the FAA is handling all of that. But once the aircraft is on the ground, the FAA no longer has jurisdiction. So the rules and regulations come from the cities. So city ordinances to allow this kind of a short takeoff and landing kind of experience that's passenger carrying, that's not just public safety, which most of our helicopters that fly around now are either news or public safety or owned by, you know, someone that's cutting, you know, across town to get to their destination. But to have a taxi experience, there will be a whole set of rules that need to be adopted.
Are there concerns about the heat here in the summer? Like, I know, for example, some of the companies that were looking to do drone deliveries realized that they couldn't fly the drones above a certain temperature. Is that a concern for these vehicles as well?
It's being looked at. Certainly one of the analysts that I've talked to, he keeps saying, and the only thing Phoenix has against it is it's hot. Mm. But then you talk to NASA and NASA's like, we land on Mars. You know, we can do things that are unpredictable and what might seem unattainable for others. So it is, you know, battery, as we know, as we drive around in Phoenix, batteries don't last well in the heat, and these are battery operated vehicles. So it's all being worked on right now.
What kinds of costs might we be looking at? I know we're still very early in this, but, you know, if you're talking about using these as air taxis, how do you make it so that they are cost effective to be able to compete with ground transportation?
That's going to be something that absolutely has to work, or consumers aren't going to adopt it. And as with most technology, it starts out more expensive. And sometimes the early adopters are people that have more disposable income. So I think the prices will probably start higher at the outset when it's not at scale, when there aren't as many vehicles, and will come down. A few of the manufacturers started by talking about it being the same price as an Uber Black, and they've kind of backpedaled from that statement. I think it might be a little bit more than that.
I'm curious about safety concerns in terms of whether these craft are safe to be up in the air with, you know, who and what might be on them, along with everything else in the sky and like takeoff and landing, especially, you know, something so new. Is there a concern that people are going to look at these and be like, yeah, that seems really cool, but maybe you try it first and we'll see how it goes?
The aircraft are being produced to what the aviation industry calls 10 to the minus 9 standards. So that is the highest level of safety for commercial jets. And that's where the FAA is certifying them. So from an aircraft safety perspective, they're running through scenarios that are new, that they wouldn't run through necessarily with a commercial jet, just because of the battery propulsion systems. They won't be certified if they don't meet that 10 to the minus 9 standard. I have zero worry at all about that. When it comes to where we're going to operate them over congested cities and how we're going to land them and the curiosity of people, then it's a different conversation because they may be operated outside of an airport, and most likely they will be. So I think all of that will be worked out in as one of those, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it, but they're working on the regulations related to that and the safety net that has to go around the ground operations in order for that to happen.
All right. Michelle, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Michelle Olson is Chief Client Officer and Head of the Aerospace and Defense and Advanced Air Mobility Practice for the PR and marketing firm Lambert.
All right, we're going to head back out to the polls on this Election Day morning where the show's Sam Dingman has been talking to voters. Do we have you back on the line there, Sam?
Yes, I am here. Take two.
All right. Tell us where you've been this morning.
I am in Glendale, and I've spent a bunch of time this morning at a couple of locations. First, the LDS Church at Pinnacle Peak, and then at the Community of Christ Church, also here in Glendale.
All right. What's the mood like? We've already seen long lines at early voting sites in the last few weeks at many times. What's it been like so far out where you are this morning?
Well, it's been a very interesting stark contrast, I have to say. I was at the LDS Church for a while, and nobody came in to vote. They were actually still, going around putting up the sandwich boards that said vote here. And the only folks that I spoke to were actually a couple of church representatives who told me I, quote, wasn't allowed to be there and asked me to leave.
Interesting. All right. So what voters have you heard from at this point? What are they saying?
Well, at Community of Christ Church, it was a completely different story. I wouldn't say there were long lines, but there have been a steady stream of voters coming in and out of the polling place. Anecdotally, I should say almost all of them were wearing some form of Trump campaign merchandise. And they have had a lot of interesting things to say. One first-time voter actually told me that he was very excited to cast his first vote in a presidential election. And I asked him what the issue that was exciting him to vote the most was, and he told me it was the price of gas. I also spoke to his brother, who said that his main issue is wanting to buy a house. And this was reflective of many of the folks that I talked to, these very immediate kind of practical concerns. I did speak to another guy who told me that the thing that fascinates him the most about this election, and I have to say this is a point I hadn't heard too many other folks make, is that voters have a choice between two presidential candidates who both have relatively recent White House experience. Former President Trump obviously was president for 4 years, and Vice President Harris has been vice president for almost that much time. And he said he can't recall another time in his lifetime when voters have had to make a less speculative decision.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. Any issues that have come up with voters that you talked to at this point?
Yes, I would say other than those very immediate practical concerns, the two biggest things on the folks' minds that I have spoken to are foreign policy. They have said repeatedly that they would like to see an end to all wars. That's something that five or six people used that exact language. They would like to see an end to all wars. And actually, one of the Republican Party representatives I spoke to who was doing some electioneering, I should say, well into the allowable area where that is allowed, told me he was a Vietnam veteran. And he said that something that is very important to him is that the military should be used as a last resort, and that he feels strongly that former President Trump has the ability to intimidate foreign leaders out of conflicts before they start.
Very interesting stuff from the polls this morning around the Valley. That is the show's Sam Dingman. Sam, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why this artist says there's no such thing as talent.
And she said, oh, I can't paint. My sister's the artist. She's the one who got that gene. And I just looked at her and said, your sister didn't take art away from you.
Writer and artist Amy Stewart tells us more about her philosophy on skill building later on in the show.
But first, something not election related. In fact, far from it. Okay, Mark, here is an Arizona trivia question for you.
All right, hit me.
What is the state mammal of Arizona?
You know, I'm honestly not sure, but I have a sense I'm about to find out.
That's right, you will. It is the ringtail, often erroneously called the ringtail cat. It's a little cat-like creature that's actually part of the raccoon family. It sort of looks like a cat-raccoon hybrid with a big, fluffy, ringed tail.
That sounds pretty cute.
It really is. But these little creatures are having a harder time today as we build further into the desert and come into closer and closer contact with what's now called urban wildlife. The Southwest Wildlife Conservation Center says it's seen a significant increase in ringtail rescues this year as they're sneaking into closets and pipes and looking for water and food. Kim Carr is animal care manager for the Southwest Wildlife Conservation Center, and I spoke with her more about it.
If you ask any Arizona native, sometimes they don't even know what a ringtail is. They've never heard of a ringtail, but it actually is the Arizona state mammal and incredibly interesting little critters, very lots of neat adaptations and characteristics about them. But you don't see them very often because they're very secretive and mainly nocturnal.
Right, right. They're elusive, right? And they tend to live in these sort of odd places, it seems.
Yeah, they find little niches and rocky crevices and mine shafts and people's attics. You know, they can get themselves into such tiny little places. So you really just don't see them very often. They're just really well hidden. They have made their way into a lot of different, you know, Arizona folklore and whatnot.
Okay, so let's talk about what's happening now with ringtails, because this is not a great development. Your organization says they've seen a big increase in ringtails needing rescue this year. And that's kind of common across the board. But these particular animals, because of some of the attributes that you've described here, are being found in some difficult scenarios, it sounds like.
Yes. And, you know, by our numbers increasing, it's not going to sound like a lot, but to us, it's a lot because we might only see a ringtail every other year. So it's not a really common animal that we take in, that we care for. Mm-hmm. But for some reason this year, in the past 6 months to a year, we've received 5 of them, which again, numbers wise, that's not a huge number. But considering that we only see one every couple of years, and that is a large amount of ringtails for us. And they're coming from different scenarios, getting themselves into trouble in different ways and needing our help.
Right. So you've rescued ringtails in like odd places, like a school closet, a pickup truck, a medical facility, a tortilla factory. Talk a little bit about the situations they've found themselves in.
There's kind of a touristy area out past, like, by the Superstition Mountains, and it's called Tortilla Flat.
Right.
So it's kind of got a historical area. There's a saloon / restaurant out there that people can, you know, it's open. People can visit there, eat there. So it's kind of a little touristy destination. Mm-hmm. And some of the workers there in the restaurant called our emergency line, and they had found a ringtail that had gotten into, it's called an oil transfer tube, but it's where the oil from the fryer is stored. And there was no oil inside the tube, but of course there was a lot of residue in there because oil, you know, sticks to everything. And some rainwater had also gotten in there. So that was kind of mixed together. And somehow the ringtail got in there and was covered in this oily residue. He was wet, sopping wet. And the workers were able to get him into a box because he wasn't doing very well. They didn't have to try too hard. And they called our rescue line. And that's when we sent one of our volunteers out there to go get this little guy.
Man, oh man. So they can find themselves, because they like to go into these little spaces, in some difficult spaces. Are the ones that you've found and that you've rescued this year, have they been in bad condition?
A couple of them have been just fine. They found themselves in a place that maybe they could not get out of, or maybe they could have, but you know, you can't really have a ringtail hanging out in a closet at a school for various reasons. You don't want a wild animal running rampant in a school. And it's possible that that animal could have gotten itself out, but of course, you know, wanted to err on the side of caution, and they ended up, you know, getting the ringtail out of that school, which was good. Mm-hmm. But some of them come in and they are perfectly healthy. They might just need to find another place to live. But we have had several people that were malnourished, you know, really thin. And of course, the one from Tortilla Flat wasn't doing great. He had ingested some of the oil in his lungs. And so it took a lot of care to get that animal healthy. But luckily, some of them do come to us, and then it's a really quick turnaround. Those can be released pretty quickly. And, you know, those are obviously the stories that we love, that we just kind of have to find a new home for them. And the other ones might take some more intense medical care and time to rehabilitate.
Right. And if you can, you'll just release them back into the wild, maybe into an environment that's a little less urban.
Absolutely. And, you know, we try to find a really good place for them, especially if we're rescuing them someplace where they've kind of gotten themselves into a pickle. We want to take them away from that place. You know, that is their habitat and that's probably their home range, but we don't want them to get into trouble again. And the urban wildlife thing, you know, people always think that wild animals are out in the desert and they're really far removed away from civilization and people. And really, they're just living among us now. And that's the way it's going to be from now on.
Right. So let's talk about that, because that trend seems to be increasing. And we see more and more stories like this of animals getting themselves into tough situations with people, or stuck, as these ringtails might find themselves. Is this just about, you know, us building and moving into their habitat more and more?
There's a lot of different factors. Of course, that's one of it. We're just, you know, building out and taking over more and more habitat. And a lot of these animals are learning to coexist with humans, which is great, because we certainly don't want to drive anything to extinction or to, you know, being endangered. So they are living amongst us in our neighborhoods, and they're kind of learning to adapt. And some of it might be because, you know, if you have a hot year, or you have a year where it was, you know, a huge drought year. And so they're getting forced to kind of come into those urban areas to look for food and water. So there's just a lot of different things that go into why you see so many animals in neighborhoods. But again, you know, that's where they can almost find all the resources that they need. It's one-stop shopping for wild animals, basically, are in our neighborhoods, in our cities, unfortunately.
Does this have to do with the intense heat that we experienced here this summer as well, more so than usual?
We did seem to get a lot of animals come in that were extremely heat stressed, dehydrated. And we do get animals like that every summer, especially some of the younger animals, maybe animals that are orphaned or somehow got separated from their mothers, that come in really bad condition. But because we had such an extreme summer this summer, where it was just, as everyone knows that lived through it, the heat was relentless, and it didn't rain. So you think about these wild animals, that they have all these adaptations to be able to survive without water for a while. Mm-hmm. At some point, they're going to need some water. And we received a lot of animals that were, you know, in dire need because of just the lack of moisture out there and the lack of being able to find water. So it was a pretty rough summer for wildlife.
Hmm. Tell us what other kinds of examples of this you're seeing. Like, would people be surprised at the kinds of animals that are being affected by the heat this way? Is it native animals that are, you know, used to the desert as well?
Even native animals, there are some animals that maybe can survive their whole life only getting the moisture from their food. There are certain rodents that they don't ever need to drink a drop of water. They can get all the moisture that they can from the seeds and the food that they eat. But, you know, mammals, the wild mammals do need water. They get a lot of water from their food, but, you know, they can't go without water forever. So they're having to search longer and harder to find water sources. And especially when there is just no rain, it might just be a water puddle from a rain shower, and maybe that's all they need for a while. But when we're not even getting any rain substantially at all summer, then it's really detrimental to the wildlife.
All right. Kim Carr, Animal Care Manager at the Southwest Wildlife Conservation Center, joining us. Kim, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Carr told me her biggest piece of advice is to not feed animals you might find in your neighborhood or out and about, even if it's out of the kindness of your heart. Be sure to keep a distance. Don't try to catch them yourselves. And more often than not, they'll move on.
The 2024 water year saw lower than normal precipitation across Arizona and the hottest summer on record here. Those facts are perhaps not surprising, but what might be a little unexpected is that drought conditions in Arizona were a little better at the beginning of this October than at the same time last year. Mike Crimmins is an extension specialist and climatologist with the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension. He contributed to the Water Year Report from the National Integrated Drought Information System and joins me to talk about what it says. And Mike, what to you were some of the key takeaways here?
The interesting thing is that this report came out right in the middle of the just string of record heat at the end of a early retreating monsoon. So we were baking with these record temperatures, hadn't rained much, especially in Phoenix over the course of the monsoon season, and it kind of retreated early. But this report was detailing the water year. And so the water year is actually this period of time from October of the previous year through September 30th. And so that water year, which is really tuned up to try to catch the winter as a whole in the middle, was actually quite interesting for the Southwest. And I think we forgot that it was actually quite wet and cool last winter and into last spring. And so if you put all that together in a water year report, you get this interesting mix of cool and wet conditions followed by a somewhat miserable summer at the tail end of the water year.
Well, yeah, I mean, sort of to that point, the report mentions that Arizona experienced its hottest summer on record, which spans about 130 years. But then when you look at the actual map with the increasingly, dark shades of red indicating drought, the map from October 1st of this year looked a lot less dark red than the map from October 3rd of last year.
I know. We've been kind of hitting the guardrails over the last couple of years, and we can even go back to the really miserable summer of 2020, when we broke all the records as far as no monsoon precipitation across much of the state. And then since then, we've been kind of cycling between. We had two La Nina winters. La Nina winters typically give us drier than average conditions in the Southwest. One of those did. The second winter of La Nina actually gave us wet conditions. And then we ended up having a quite dry monsoon last year of 2023. It was actually below average much of the state. Broke a bunch of temperature records at that point. And then we actually had an El Nino event, which typically gives us above average precipitation for the Southwest, come online last fall. And it actually delivered. We ended up having a pretty good winter, cooled temperatures down a bit, and brought us some decent precipitation. And then, of course, we can't enjoy that for too long. We went into this monsoon season, and then pretty mediocre precipitation. Some parts of the state did okay, came in an average. Some real small areas had above average precipitation. But I think, as you know, in Phoenix, it was not so great. And so kind of the middle part of the state, up into the eastern part of the state, parts of the southeast part of the state just really fell behind. And then the heat just set in and it's still kind of holding on to us right now.
Right. Well, and as far as water goes, the report notes that Lakes Mead and Powell are still pretty far below where they ought to be.
Yeah. I mean, and the reservoirs operate on much, much longer timescales. You know, so we're hitting the guardrails from season to season, and the decline in the big reservoirs, and that's really what they're designed to do, is to kind of absorb all of these kind of shocks to the system at the shorter timescales. They've been trending down for many, many years. And so we had a couple of good winters, and that's the way that we would actually try to reverse that trend up with the rivers, but it's just not been enough. And, you know, we're fighting against climate change as well, where climate change, these warming temperatures just make the runoff efficiency, the ability of that snow to turn into stream flow, gets into those reservoirs, we just lose that efficiency over time.
Hmm. So I'm curious what you make of, all of this, as we've been discussing, sort of dichotomous data coming. Obviously, there's some logistical reasons for it and some sort of timing reasons for it. But if you just read the report, it seems like there's quite a bit of juxtaposition of really good news and like not great news all sort of rolled into one, along with, as you referenced, some surprises thrown in there about what we got relative to what we expected. So like, I'm curious what you make of all that.
Yeah, that's pretty normal for Arizona climate is all of these juxtapositions all the time. And it's the interesting thing about even studying drought here down in Arizona is that drought really is, there's no one definition for it. And so we have to think about it in terms of time scales. So if you're worried about the reservoirs and you're thinking about stream flow in the Colorado River, it's big, long time scales. If you're worried about fire, if you're worried about grazing, you're going to be thinking about much, much shorter time scales on seasons. So it's not uncommon for us to end up having a good season or maybe two seasons of precipitation and things actually really turn around and look quite good on the landscape. Maybe fire risk goes down. we end up having forage for livestock, but at the same time, we can still end up having that drought signal in the reservoirs. So you can end up having a conversation about drought, and it can be a good conversation and a bad conversation at the same time, depending on what you're focusing on.
So is any of this in any way predictive of what we can expect going into the fall and winter and spring of 2025?
Yeah. So one of the things that we rely on here in the Southwest is we pay real close attention to the seasonal outlooks issued by the Climate Prediction Center, which are really finely tuned to the El Nino Southern Oscillation. And so right now we're looking at La Nina forming. This one's been really quite interesting. It's been very fickle, quite slow to form. The models aren't super sure how strong it's going to peak at, but there's still a decent chance we'll have a weak La Nina event that will come online kind of midwinter. And typically what that does for us is it moves the jet stream pattern to the north. And so that will take some of those storms out of play that we would really rely on to give us an above average or average winter and probably lean us into the below average precipitation category for winter precipitation. So right now, again, this is imperfect science from the forecasting perspective. Right now we're leaning towards a below average precipitation forecast for the upcoming winter and probably above average temperatures, because when it's dry here, it's typically warm.
Right. Well, so then does that make, assuming that comes to pass, would that make the monsoon season next summer more important in terms of trying to sort of keep pace with getting some amount of precipitation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We really, and that's, I think, really interesting feature about Arizona that I think we live down here and we know this, but I don't think we appreciate the fact that we have two wet seasons. We have the winter, which is very unique. You know, it's upper elevation snowfall. It's typically these long duration, low intensity precipitation gives us soil moisture that leads into the springtime. And then the monsoon is the other season that we really rely on this precipitation, is that it's really hard for us to string together two average seasons, let alone three. And so, yeah, we ended up having not a great monsoon, I think, by all accounts. If this winter is dry, we're really going to start sliding back into those short-term drought conditions. You're going to start seeing the U.S. Drought Monitor, which we're already seeing, start to fill back in across Arizona. And then we will really look to the monsoon season to hopefully start on time. And so, yeah, we're already thinking, you know, 8 months out what next monsoon might look like.
All right. That is Mike Crimmins, a climatologist with the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension, also an extension specialist there. Mike, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Good talking with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
And now it's time for the latest edition in our series featuring local creatives and makers made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risk in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings and try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Today, meet fashion designer and all-around creator, Cass Hoverson, a.k.a. Crummy.
How many hours do you think a week you spend sitting here listening to that sound?
More than a 9-to-5, I can tell you that.
We're in the living room of her Phoenix apartment on a hot afternoon, and we're surrounded by her work, which makes it feel a little like you've entered into a different world.
So right now I'm really into totes, and so I'm just making a bunch of silly little totes. And this one specifically, I'm going to label all the pockets kind of unconventional things like secrets and elixir and things like that, just to make people giggle a little bit. That's my main goal with all my projects.
With making people giggle as a central goal, Hoverson has built up her clothing brand, Crummy, with a sense of the weird, whether it's a truly giant jacket, pants with fingers reaching toward the floor, or a shirt with 8 functional sleeves.
My craft is kind of my escape from reality, and I like to create a world where people can step in and question their own reality, and I like to play with proportions, so that's kind of inspired some of these projects.
Case in point, a 6 foot tall shirt in baby blue with a fuzzy fur collar.
This was made to be kind of a backdrop for a dressing booth that I was kind of manning. So I wanted people to be able to interact with the shirt and, you know, put their heads inside the buttons and just play around with it. Because I made this for a show where the theme was the power of play. So I took it quite literally.
Quite literally. I mean, you do have a lot of fun with the work that you do, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, why do something that's not fun? I'm like, you want to get in this shirt?
I kind of do. So, I mean, I think that sounds like it connects really to why you got into this to begin with. Like, you've been sewing most of your life, it sounds like, but it was a pandemic thing, right? Where you sort of switched paths and said, like, you know what? I'm going to do what I like.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, the pandemic kind of put everything in perspective to me. And I said, oh, you know, we are pretty fragile and the world is going to end eventually. So why don't I just do what I love to do?
What do you love about it?
I just love the freedom and creativity. I like to feel that there's no limits to what I can do. And I'm very grateful to have the tools and resources I have so I can create an alternate reality, basically.
So I want to turn you around here and look at this big shelf full of different materials. You work with only found materials, essentially, stuff you get at thrift shops, Goodwill.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like there's enough material in the world for us to have everything we need. So there's no need to indulge in new materials.
There's got to be a challenge in that, though, right? Because you're not starting with a blank slate. You're starting with something that already is made into something. So you're taking it apart. I see like a ton of jeans here, right? That you've cut up and you turn them into something else.
Yeah, exactly. And it can be limiting sometimes, but also more so I would say I get inspired by secondhand materials because, you know, I could go in the shower curtain aisle and find a shower curtain that inspires a project from that, from the shower curtain being so wacky.
Okay, so we have to talk about this piece that you have out here too, because it's a jacket with a collar, but then how many sleeves are here?
Let's count. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 sleeves.
So is the idea that you could choose whichever sleeve you want to put your arms through?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you get bored with one sleeve or need to, like, if you want to switch it up a little bit, you got options. Someone who has had a newborn baby actually tried it on, and she's like, this would be perfect for breastfeeding.
So it's whimsical. You're kind of playing with these ideas of clothing, restructuring them. What kinds of reactions do you get from folks?
Oh, kind of all over the board. Some people kind of look at it and kind of like give a forced smile and walk away, but other people get really into it. You know, just like they get inspired from, you know, experiencing a little taste of my world. So that's cool.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're kind of letting them into your world when you do this and when you make these pieces? Is it an entrance point?
Yeah, definitely. That's the goal. That's a good way to put it. A little portal.
I want to ask a little bit about your approach to this. Like, when you have an idea, I ask this of musicians often, how do they start a song? Is it the lyric? Is it a picture? Is it a tune in their head? So when you're approaching clothing or, you know, an accessory like a tote, where does the idea begin for you? Is it the material that you collect and have, you know, a bunch of here?
Yeah, I would say I get inspired a lot by material. But also sometimes it starts with a doodle. I could just take my pen and just doodle around. And then that's how the anti-anxiety chair, you know, came to be, was just from me doodling.
So, yeah, describe this for us.
Yeah, for some reason, I really like to humanize things. Even like at my old apartment, I had eyeballs and I put a wig on my door. I don't know why. But so this chair is kind of in alignment with that. I put a wig on it and I made some big exaggerated arms and hands and stuffed them. So then when you sit in it, you can bring the arms around your body and give yourself a hug. And then I put fur on the seat. So there's like that sensory element. And so I like to call it the anti-anxiety chair.
Sensory element.
It's like when you sit in it, you know, you'll feel a little better.
Yeah. So your work goes beyond clothing, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to get outside of the fashion designer box that I've kind of put myself in, and I am trying to explore other avenues like furniture design and sculptures and things, because these also bring me pleasure as well. And it's a whole, I just like to create in 3D. So things like this, I think, are really fun.
So to you, it doesn't matter if somebody wears it. It's about somebody experiencing it in kind of a more complete way.
Exactly, yeah.
How did you get into sewing at, I mean, a young age, it sounds like?
Yeah, my grandma taught all of the females in our family to sew. And when we all turned 12 for Christmas, we all got a sewing machine for a Christmas present. So yeah, I kind of just stuck with it. And I started making clothes seriously in 2020.
Do you remember the first piece that you made, or like the first thing you put together in that moment in the pandemic when, you know, everyone's stuck at home and you decide, you know, screw it, I'm going to do what I love?
Yeah, it was kind of just a basic shirt, but I think it quickly, within the first couple months, turned to, like, you know, sewing little eyeballs and making like a million eyeballs on a shirt and, you know, things like that. I really started pushing the boundaries early on.
So I wonder this with fashion, especially, and if you're looking at like creating lifestyle stuff as well, where do you want to take it?
It's a good question. I'm kind of taking it day by day. I think my ultimate goal would be bigger scale, because I kind of see myself as a creator versus a fashion designer. So I would love to be able to kind of curate or like create mini Meow Wolf-esque type installations.
There's definitely a Meow Wolf vibe here. Okay, I can see that. What do you mean when you say installations?
You know how I like to say, you know, I'm kind of creating my own little reality or own little world. I want to take that more of a literal sense and create an installation where people can come and experience things and touch things and interact with things. I think that would be really beautiful to see, because I really do get joy of people interacting with my stuff and like seeing a smile on their face. I think life shouldn't be taken too seriously, so I like to create whimsical things to remind people of that.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Cass, for having us. I really appreciate you showing us around.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Cass Hoverson, the creator behind Crummy. She'll be hosting a workshop on the fast fashion world at Scottsdale's Canal Convergence this Sunday, November 10th. And you can see pictures of Hoverson and her studio on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. And while you're there, check out the rest of our Made in Arizona series. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Amy Stewart is an accomplished writer. She's perhaps best known for the New York Times bestseller The Drunken Botanist, a kind of mixed media love letter to cocktails and plants. But she's also written 16 other books, including her most recent, The Tree Collectors, a combination of stories and her own original watercolor paintings. Stewart is, by any definition, a successful artist. But in a recent post on her Substack, she makes a provocative claim, quote, "There's no such thing as talent." The title comes from an experience she frequently has when she's sitting in the park with her paints or her sketchbook. People often come up to her and say, "I wish I could do what you do. I just don't have the talent." As Stewart recently told the show's Sam Dingman, people who say that are depriving themselves the pleasure of their own artistry.
On one hand, that makes me sad, because I want people to know that something like drawing and painting is a technical skill and anyone can learn it. But also, it sort of negates the 20 years of taking classes and practicing that I had to do to learn how to make a passable sketch of some trees in the park down the street from my house.
Yes. So yeah. This is my favorite part of the piece. And I think in a way, saying someone has talent is a little reductive. And one of the ways that you make that argument is in your essay, you trace the origins of the word talent, which are very surprising and quite illuminating. So tell us what you found.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a writer, so I love thinking about what words really mean. And what I was wondering was, when did we get the idea that if someone's doing something with a great deal of skill, they were born with that ability? So you look back at the meaning of that word and you start to see people being described as talented going back a few hundred years. But before that, there's a definition of talent as the amount of wealth that a person earns over their working life. And I thought, well, that's very interesting, because if you think of what someone has accumulated over their working life, and we call that a talent, then if you apply that to someone's skills and abilities, it means Not that they were born with it, but that they worked for it and earned it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm quite drawn to it because it offers an interpretation of the word talent as a stand-in, not for some innate ability, but rather a stand-in for like decades of dedication and honoring of impulse. And it felt to me like one of the things you were gesturing at in this essay, and I'm curious to know if you agree with this, is that there's a difference between talent and craft.
Well, for sure. Look, I think what we think of today when we think of talent is someone who's just born with absolute bonkers genius ability to do some particular thing, like play the saxophone. And, you know, instead, I think what is really true is that someone who's incredibly good at playing the saxophone has been playing it for an incredibly long time with a lot of interest and commitment. It's in the back of your mind all the time. For me as a painter, I'm walking down the street and I'm looking at the fall colors in the trees and thinking, that's not so much a yellow ochre, but if I took like a deep cadmium yellow and I mixed a little bit of red into it, but also a little blue just to knock that back a bit, I could get that color.
Yeah. If I'm hearing you right, the only motivation in wanting to find that color is that it will satisfy something very deep within you. It's not like, then I can finally sell that painting.
Right. You know? Yeah. It's more about, it's the thing that you're interested in that your brain tends to want to go ruminate on when it's not doing anything else. You know, when your brain is at rest, what does it start thinking about? Like when you're on a long road trip, right? What do you naturally gravitate towards?
Yeah. Well, and one of the things about this new framework that you're proposing, I think, is that it moves away from something that particularly American culture does a lot, which is to treat talent as a commodity. And I think that's a big part of what's behind this inclination that we have to say that it's this gift that is either bestowed or not bestowed.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think people literally do this. And I can't remember if it was the same essay or the one I wrote the next week. I told a story about a woman who struck up a conversation with me like this one day. And she said, I can't paint. My sister's the artist. She's the one who got that gene. And I just looked at her and said, your sister didn't take art away from you. And she just stopped and stared at me and she repeated it. She was like, my sister didn't take art away from me. And I'm like, no, she didn't. And she goes, I'm going to go tell my therapist you said that. And I said, go right ahead, but enroll in an art class.
Yeah. Well, and I can confirm that story about the woman going to talk to her therapist was in the essay that I read, because I remember being very moved by that exchange that you just described. And I think what's so beautiful about it is, again, what you're proposing is this idea that talent isn't a gift that some people get and others don't.
Right.
It's actually a gift that you can give yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in the piece, and you even mentioned in our conversation, this idea that hearing people express the idea that talent isn't available to them makes you sad.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes you sad about that?
Well, they're telling kind of a sad story about themselves. They're saying, I would love to have the experience that you're having right now. I would love to sit in a park with a sketchbook and some watercolors. That looks wonderful, but I can't. And, you know, I think this is kind of what people really mean. Like, when people walk by and see me out making art in the outdoors, doing plein air painting or whatever, and they say, I wish I could do that. What they really mean is do. Like, I want to be sitting on that rock on the edge of the river with a sketchbook. What a nice way to spend time.
Yeah. Yeah.
They mostly just want to do it rather than what you get out of the sketchbook. But that's one of the reasons I love working in a sketchbook, is none of it's for sale. But it's that daily practice. Kind of like running. You know, runners, they get out and they run every day because it's satisfying to run and it makes them feel good. And it's the dailiness of running that feels so good. And I think it's the everyday kind of regularness of playing the guitar or drawing pictures or sewing or whatever it is, that it's about kind of building a life that has this really satisfying, inherently satisfying component to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So can I ask you, so far for you personally, we've been talking about your relationship with painting and drawing. How do you think about this when it comes to your writing, which is another thing that you are extremely skilled at and which, if I'm not mistaken, does pay
Yeah, I know. Right. I mean, writing does pay all my bills. I'm a full-time writer. It's the only thing I do to earn a living. So I have to say, I kind of have a different relationship to it because I generally don't start writing a book until I have a contract from a publisher. But also, I write on Substack because I'm free of the constraints of a book contract and I can bang out any idea I have and send it out into the world, and there it goes. And this essay on talent is actually one of those. So I do still kind of write as a hobby in a way, like that's what Substack is. And I think that's what so many writers love about it is like, I'm going to write this today and hit send tonight and move on to the next thing. And that is not how it works when you're writing a book for a publisher.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is such an important distinction that I think you're pointing out is, yes, you are a professional writer in that maybe you would not write an entire book absent a contract, but that doesn't mean that you wouldn't write.
Exactly.
Well, that Substack that Amy is talking about is called It's Good to Be Here. That is where this essay on talent and how it does not exist was first published. Amy Stewart, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. A reminder, today's Election Day, in case you didn't know that. I'm not sure how that would be possible.
In case you haven't heard.
So if you haven't voted, make sure you vote. And then make sure to tune in to KJZZ for special coverage starting at 5 tonight. Local coverage starting at 8 o'clock for the latest on the Arizona ballot. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have her right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.